Okay, we are live. This is the Apollo 13 crew that are going to try to bring in another Google Chat for you all. And thank you, everybody from all over the world who we know is listening. And thanks for all the questions you've sent in. We greatly appreciate them. I'm Larry Rosenstock. I'm the CEO of High Tech High, and also somebody who taught this course live at Cal Berkeley for several years. And I want to introduce Casimir and also Feroz, two of our people today, who are people who both took that course live and suffered through it with me. Thank you for being willing to be with me again, Casimir. And Feroz, everybody who's out there needs to know, did a long workshop today, so he's not choking on something. He just has lost his voice. Even though he's lost his voice, he's got something to say. And then we have Kate, who's here from San Francisco, and we have Tyler from San Francisco, and David Stevens. So what I'd like each of you to do, and we're going to do it pretty much in the order that I call out, we would like first Casimir to say something about yourself as a means of introduction, then David, then Feroz, then Kate, then Patrick, then Tyler. All right? Casimir.
Hi, everyone. My name is Casimir. I was a student at UC Berkeley while I was getting my master's in public policy, and I have a strong interest in social policy as a whole, and with that, education policy. So I was really excited to take this course and very happy that Larry invited me back.
Great. Terrific. Thank you. David?
Hi, everybody. I'm David Steven. I'm with you from Boston, Massachusetts, where we're about to get a big snowstorm. I'm having a little trouble hearing in terms of my connection, so if I have to ask people to repeat, that's why. I've worked with Larry Rosenstock for the last 23 years. I started out as an architect, left the architectural profession after about 7 years and became a teacher. My passion has been in project-based teaching and learning, and I was fortunate to be part of the founding crew at High Tech High, and after a few years of being there, found myself getting more and more into designing the spaces, both for High Tech High type of the schools that we were developing there, but also around the country. And so the last 10 years, that's what I've been doing. I've worked with many flavors of schools. I work with a lot of schools that are trying to do very little or a lot with very little. And I've worked with a lot of schools that are under a lot of constraints to try and maximize their facilities and at the same time connect them to innovative pedagogy.
Great. Thank you, David. Feroz.
I'll try. Hi, my name is Feroz. I don't know if this is going to work. See if my voice can find itself. I am a student at UC Berkeley, a PhD student. I worked at High Tech High for many years, for several years, and I've been a teacher for many years, working in mostly PBL schools, and now I'm doing some PBL coaching and getting my PhD in education at UC Berkeley.
Great.
And I'm not on mute.
Thank you. Thank you. Very good. Okay, Kate.
Hi, I'm Kate Ganim. I'm co-director of KidMob, which is a mobile kid integrated design firm. We primarily do design education workshops with middle school kids. I got my master's in architecture from the California College of the Arts. Prior to that, I studied psychology at Brown University. My master's thesis was on designing a primary school for progressive education, so I was pretty excited about the topic for this MOOC today.
Oh, so you can weigh in on a few things here. That's great. Patrick, Tyler, you came up. Tyler, go ahead.
So my name is Tyler Pugh. I'm a co-director of KidMob as well. Like Kate said, I as well got my master's in architecture in 2012, in which I focus on how spaces actually affect the way we interact with each other. I've been fascinated with how it can potentially change school environments as well as public space.
Great. And Patrick, the man with the tattoo.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to week 5.
Okay, great. Thanks, Patrick. Patrick's been my co-pilot from the beginning, and we're all going down together. Okay, so our first question, I usually identify to everyone out there who wrote the question, but several of them are unnamed, so I won't say your name because I don't have it. And I also typically will identify the state or country from which you're calling from. And the first question, by the way, these questions get ranked by all of you in terms of popularity, so that's where they're coming from. Can you talk about maker spaces in schools and what you've noticed and or experienced so far about them? And I'm going to look to David, and I'm hoping that maybe someone from KidMob will contribute something after that.
Okay. Well, let's see. Where can I start? I guess the notion of makerspace is relatively new for me, just in the last few years, more specifically looking at, okay, a makerspace. Before that, I guess I heard a lot about fabrication labs or fab labs, and or engineering labs, or in our sort of roots at a vocational, in a vocational setting, all the technology labs. So I think of makerspaces as having many, many different flavors. And of course, there's technology that's involved. There's flexible furniture. There's enough space to move around. There's storage for all the materials you need. And there's sort of the ability to adapt the space or maybe have different zones within it to facilitate lots of different types of work, of hands-on work. I also think of makerspace as the D school at Stanford, where there's so many moving parts and lots of places to write down ideas and lots of ways to sort of transform the space. More recently, I've been thinking, and I think this is when we think about a school like High Tech High and learning environments that support the program at High Tech High, it's more like the idea of a maker campus, not just a maker space. It's not just one space that sort of facilitates that maker and design thinking, but a whole combination of elements within a variety of learning environments where you have varied spaces, where you have the ability to transform environments, move furniture around, and adapt to lots of different types of teaching and learning modes.
Okay, very good. Thanks a lot. And I would also add, before moving over to KidLab folks, that I taught carpentry for 15 years, and of course, that's a makerspace. I often have wished that I had taken a photo of all of the remarkable things that I saw students make, and that was in the oldest vocational school in the country, Ringe Tech, which opened in 1888. And I remember, as David might, Fred Perry, who could do anything with metal at all, and all of the remarkable things that were done there, too. So, like a lot of ideas that we all have, like project-based learning, a lot of them are really old ideas that we're essentially revisiting. I visited a school in another country that is becoming co-ed, and in becoming co-ed, to make room for the other gender, they were taking out all of their fab shops, their fabrication shops, and they wanted to kind of be project-based, and it was really kind of difficult to watch all of these greatly equipped shops be dismantled. Okay, oh, wow. Kate or Tyler, would you like to take a shot at this question of makerspaces in schools and what you've experienced or noticed?
Yeah, I think I'm on mute now. Am I not? Okay.
You're good.
Okay. Yeah, I think from KidMob's perspective, it's been interesting because across the board we see a lot of integration and a desire to integrate the idea of makerspaces within the educational system. Oftentimes they don't know how to do that, first of all. And then second of all, it's not a full integration in a way that they're looking at integrating into the curriculum as well as like the overall like pedagogy and the feel of the school. So I think that puts it in a kind of a difficult place right now where it's something that's sought after and talked about and wanted but also not known how to actually integrate into the classroom. We've had a fortunate experience where we worked with a school doing our workshop model in which we actually were given one classroom. We gutted that classroom, and then we allowed the students to actually design out what that makerspace actually looks like. So they decided everything from the table locations to where things, where the tools were put, how things were accessible, what kind of materials went in there, things like that. What was really exciting is you can take an old school framework, which is an empty box basically, and you don't need to retool that towards like a heavy duty shop or anything like that, but you can actually get accessible tools and things like that and put those into a classroom. Then the next step is working with the teachers of the integration of actual making and how to think about making in project-based learning and how to integrate that into their curriculum.
Terrific, thank you. Anyone else want to weigh in there?
I could add one or two things that have occurred to me just based on what you guys have been saying, and that is I think that what I've noticed is in terms of thinking about this maker campus and the kind of integrative thinking that needs to happen, that a lot of times it's around adjacencies of spaces that create the sort of the environment or the possibility for that integration to take place. So just placing a sort of a project room where you can get messy next to a science classroom or a math classroom or an English classroom opens up a lot of possibilities for that kind of integration to take place. And one other element too is that in any maker space or maker campus, you want to see a lot of display and exhibition because it's all about visible learning as well and the sharing of ideas. So you want those ideas to be really kind of palpable and have lots of venues for display.
Great, very good. Okay, thank you. The next question is from an unnamed person as well. Most new schools have to take any space that they can get, usually a subdivision of an old school. What would you do to make the best of this situation? And I think that David was going to leave, but I want to just say one thing about that, because I talked to a lot of people who are looking at just from the scratch what to do, and I always urge people to get old warehouses if possible, because having height and light and having the structure of the building be revealed to children, just like kids' museums now do, is really very helpful. They sort of they understand in the maker space how the space was actually made by making it plain and making it visible. So, David, who's going to comment on this question about taking any space that's within an existing school?
Sure, and that's definitely the position that a lot of schools and a lot of charter schools in particular find themselves in, trying to sort of do more with less. When I did a bunch of work in the Los Angeles public school system with some very large high schools where we were trying to create more of a sense of small learning communities and less anonymity, and I think there are certain elements that really I think make for the creation. What you want to do is create a learning environment that has a sense of cohesion, that has a sense of identity, and that ultimately students and teachers feel real ownership over. So the elements that go into that kind of space, and I think you can do this in whatever kind of collection of spaces you have, you want to have some kind of real sense of entry and greeting. You want to have some kind of gathering space where community can be built, which feels like sort of the center or intellectual hub of the school. You want to have co-location of classrooms where teachers are working with similar cohorts of kids so that you have sort of the ability for that kind of natural integration to take place. A couple of other elements that you want to maximize in whatever space you're in is if you have transparency, being able to build in views so that people can kind of have a sort of a sense of passive sort of supervision of kids, but also just knowing and being known. Then back to the display, and also I think building in an opportunity for students and teachers to customize an environment, whether it's building murals or, you know, creating public art displays or displaying the projects that they're working on. So those are all elements, I think, that go into making for a cohesive kind of sense of small learning community. And you know, I think you can create them, and I've seen that very successfully done in some pretty subpar buildings.
Thank you, David. Casimir went to a very interesting school named Lick-Wilberding, which nobody believes, but that is its name. And Casimir, can you share with us what were the names of those different shop areas? Because as I recall, they're named after materials in particular. What were those and what happened there?
Yeah, so it's actually really nice that Lick-Wilberding is built on multi-levels, so you actually have the library, which is elevated about a few stories. You have the main area where you have the gym, cafeteria, and then you have the sub-level where you have the shops. And the shops, you had wood shop, metal shop, jewelry, and glass. And these are industrial-grade facilities. Professionals use them as well. And we actually, as freshmen, you get exposed to all the different shops. And then by your sophomore year, when I was there, you got to sort of specialize. And I just had to specialize in wood because I was really interested. But you got hands-on experience in all the different shops. In the end, we actually built a box that incorporated all the different elements. So we had the wood of the box, we had the windows and the glass lid, and a metal stand. We made jewelry to go inside of it. So it was actually a really comprehensive project that exposed all the students to the various shops.
Yeah, that what I particularly like about what you did there with Al Adams, a good friend of mine, the former head of the school, is that the shops were named after the material, which is kind of unique in my experience of such schools, rather than the tools or rather than the occupation. It was really quite good. Okay, anyone else on that, or I'm going to move on? And it looks like, seeing none, I'm going to move on to the next question. So what about the this question of repurposing old vocational schools, and what have you seen done well in that way? I mean, I don't know if we've seen too much of that, David. I mean, like Tyler is sitting there with, and he's got a maker space right behind him, you know. What was that space before, Tyler, and what are you doing in there these days? Can you give us a sense of the range of things that you're cooking up there?
Yeah, so this facility used to be an old warehouse, basically, in downtown, or Mission District of San Francisco. Now it's converted into part of it. It's office space for tech companies. I have a fabrication company in here. Then there's a design firm as well. So make anything from wood, metal, just did resin castings, things like that. So the flexibility of in one space is pretty amazing. Coming from CCA, so California College of the Arts is in an old Greyhound depot. So it's just this massive open space warehouse with beautiful windows all the way across, massive open doors, like absolutely beautiful space. Going to there to study architecture was inspiring beyond belief. But at the same time, you become critical of those elements. Often things aren't thought about in dealing with acoustics, dealing with quiet spaces or spaces that can be intimate. Because oftentimes the addressing designers address those spaces with the same kind of aesthetic, which is just a white box we put off to the side for a quiet space. Rather than trying to integrate kind of a new typology in those spaces that allows for an individual that wants to be by themselves and not inundated with acoustics from all over the place. Things like that, how people actually traverse those spaces is very interesting. Oftentimes it's long, narrow pathways that lead to larger openings, at least in this campus, the CCA campus. One thing that was effective in that was the nave, is what was called. So it's a large central space in which exhibitions were held, pinups were done, things like that. It offered a great opportunity for all the students to showcase their work, to be inspired. As soon as you come through the front door, you see somebody's work from, say, a furniture student or an industrial design student. You get to be inspired from these different facets and different kind of industries at the same time.
Yeah. And I think that also one reason why our school space was so effective is that there's a really great alignment between the pedagogy of the school and the actual space. I think that that's hugely important to take into consideration, that while there are things, are characteristics of the space that can be more or less conducive to learning, that taking into consideration what the pedagogy is, how the space is going to be used. An example of that is looking at the open schools in the 70s, how they were kind of notoriously a giant failure. It's been argued, and I think that a lot of that has to do with the fact that there's a misalignment between the pedagogy that was occupying those spaces versus the actual space itself.
Yeah, I wanted to jump in on that idea because I felt like when I came to High Tech High 6 years ago and started interacting with this space, it completely challenged every notion I had about education and how physical spaces interacted so heavily with education. Because in 1998, the school that I went to in high school built a brand new facility, but it was based on the same floor plans that all public schools are built upon. And the behaviors in the students really didn't change all that much. We had less students than the students that I taught at High Tech High in Chula Vista. We had 600 students at that school. And at my high school, we had around 400 or 500. But there was a very small college going rate. There was a very small, there was a lot of violence. And I felt like a lot of that, after I worked here for a little while, just had to do with the fact that we were all put into these anonymous kind of numbered rows in classrooms where we weren't seen. We were shifted from classroom to classroom, but a lot of that, you could become anonymous even though there was a small student body there because you were physically unable to be seen by somebody. There were ways of hiding. And I feel like at High Tech, we have a lot of open spaces, which, you know, a lot of teachers when they came in were really afraid of because they were told, like, what if a gunman comes to the school, like with the recent shootings and whatnot. But the inverse is that there's a lot more places to hide, which means there's a lot more students that can get by us and not be known at our schools if those spaces aren't open.
Okay. Good. I'm going to move on unless, okay, nothing from anyone. Okay. So the next question is interesting. Since most of us might only get one shot at designing a space, what sorts of spaces were in the original High Tech High that you thought would get a lot of use that do not now? What sorts of spaces were more popular than you thought? And that's from Tom in New Hampshire. And Tom, you know, Patrick's from New Hampshire, and there's only five people from New Hampshire, so he's really glad to hear from one of them. Well, we had a big space that we still have that I'm looking out at called the Great Room, because the original High Tech High, Tom, is in a very, very big warehouse. It's 39,000 square feet with sawtooth skylights that are north-facing, very important because we never get direct sunlight. It's always indirect, like artists prefer. And we have, just to give you an example, there are 39,000 square feet. And David, how many square feet per kid as a rule of thumb? Could you say how many square feet should schools usually have? You know, David?
I'm sorry, I'm missing a lot of what you said. Are you asking for the square footage per student?
How many square per student typically in the United States?
Okay. A lot of school districts are designing at about 160, 175 square feet per student.
Okay, so basically this is 39,000 square feet, so therefore we should have, you know, just a few very small number of 100 students, right? So 250 maybe. We've got 599 kids in here right now, and it's very, very calm and very, very purposeful. The reason we have that many is because of a freeze in funds in California since 2007. So we've survived by having more kids. If you were here during the day, it feels very calm to you. And if the ceilings were 10 feet tall, they wouldn't work. The fact that even though everybody occupies the horizontal plane of the floor, the vertical plane of altitude gives everybody a lot more literal and figurative breathing room. We then had, Tom, at the other end of the building, we had what's now called the fishbowl because it's the ninth grade classrooms with curved glass on both sides. The kids called it the fishbowl. When kids name something, good luck trying to change the name of it, by the way. And it used to be called the not, because the big room in front of me is called the great room. The room that was that's back at the other side of the building is called the not-so-great room. And that is now called the Fishbowl, but I got the sign, the Not So Great Room, which is what I proudly refer to as the office that I work in. David, anyone else have anything to say about spaces that were created? Feroz was here as well. And things that don't work, I'll add that the bathrooms are all curated. Everything is curated in this building. We weren't planning on that. Yes, David? David?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm missing about 50% of what you're saying. Okay. But I hear the gist of it. So I think that sort of the evolution of the spaces at High Tech High connect to that discussion about the open classroom. And because I think one of the things, aside from the fact that the open classroom didn't come along with the PD, that the professional development that was necessary to sort of support the teaching and learning that was going on there in many cases, it was just a question of acoustics. And what we discovered in the Great Room early on is that we really needed to be able to close the door when we wanted to, and to be able to give people quiet spaces so they could hear themselves think and hear the teacher talk. I think that's one thing. The other thing that we discovered is that instead of having this big open space that was sort of far away from where the classrooms were, it's very important to have a variety of spaces that are kind of co-located. So you have a big space where you can maybe do more kind of a variety of things, but located near maybe a small classroom or a larger classroom or a meeting room or a conference room. So having those spaces near each other allow you to kind of flow and move throughout those spaces, which connects back to also the conversation about vocational spaces, because I think that the biggest thing that I see happening in the transformation of vocational schools, I've worked on 3 or 4 of them over the last few years, is moving the academic part of the vocational program right next to the vocational part so that you're not separating them. So that your classrooms aren't just the related rooms, as we call them in voc ed, but are connected directly to the academic classrooms that they're supporting.
Very good. Okay, hey Casimir, when you think back about the shops back in Lick Wilberding, was there anything if you were doing differently about how they worked? I know they were on a separate floor all by themselves. Did they feel sort of removed from the academic agenda? Because in a lot of these schools, like ours, we're trying to really integrate them into the more academic agenda. Casimir, did you hear me? You did.
I would say that because Lick is actually sort of known. Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, 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 yes.
I would say that because Lick is known for incorporating the shops into the curriculum, I wouldn't say I felt disconnected. Actually, although it's on a lower floor, we do have a hallway that sort of connects into the classroom areas. And what's nice, although it is on a bottom floor, it's completely open. So I would walk out of a shop, which, by the way, also is completely open. It's all the walls are glass, so I can be in wood shop and look into metal shop. I can be in metal shop and look into jewelry or glass shop. So I got to see my classmates make and create different things as well, but also when I stepped out of a shop, I actually did not feel confined because it was completely open space. So I actually felt that it was structured very nicely to bring in both creativity as well as connected to the open curriculum.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else? No? Okay, I'm going to go on to the next question, which is, thank you, Casimir, from Dan, who is in Philadelphia. Dan, thanks for writing to us again. Is there a typical path or blueprint to financing for facilities? While my other guests are thinking about that one, I will say a few words about it. If I just had a group down from Washington State and they said when they left after 2 days, what's the main thing we should think about? Because they now have a new charter law. They're going to be opening charters in a year. I said, think about your building. Think about your building. You need a building. You need a building. And so I typically find that donors are more likely to give to buildings, just like universities get donors more giving to buildings than to operating costs. So don't expect it for operating costs, but hope for it for for building costs. There are some public bond financing mechanisms like new market tax credits, for example, where you go to the Treasury website and you can look up, you can give them the address of the building and see if it's just right away, see if it's eligible for those tax credits. So it's this very complicated thing to talk about right here, but I think that that is the typical plan for doing it, is you don't, unlike school districts who get bonds to do this occasionally, like in San Diego, the school district just we just passed a Prop Z where there's $330 million that's put aside specifically for charters with that money. Anybody else want to just talk about not just the question of financing specifically in that way? David, you've dealt with this a lot. Anyone else, Kate, Tyler, who's seen people and how they've creatively dealt with financing their maker spaces, even if they're rooms within buildings?
Yeah, I'll go shortly. One thing, like creative financing a lot, community buy-in is a great way, either offering the resources to community members for like adult education, as well as private grants, and then different types of industries that have a vested interest in the students becoming more aware of, say, mechanics, engineering, arts, things like that, is definitely an avenue that one of the schools we've worked with has found success in. What I would say on the sideline too is what I'd hope to see is more integration into the kids, into the actual development and the design of it. More incentive for schools to research with the kids to actually allow the kids to actually design the space in which they're going to inhabit for the next 4 to 6 years, things like that. That's a personal kind of bent on it. But I think the more incentive the school has to go after these grants, saying that they're going to invest some into student research and student design, I think the higher chance they would have in actually getting grants or financing for it.
Very good.
I would say just not so much about financing, but in terms of creative use of spaces, I've seen quite a bit on the East Coast here with the tech bubble leaving quite a few office spaces that were either newly built or extensively renovated empty. That there are lots of options. Maybe not in large city centers where their real estate values are higher, but for instance, in a school I've been working with in Andover, we looked at 4 or 5 different sites, all of which were had house businesses that folded, and that had great potential for transformation very easily into school environments because they were open spaces. They had some offices built in, conference rooms. A lot of them were, you know, had a lot of in terms of infrastructure, had a lot to offer, and really made the whole idea of converting them into schools actually quite affordable.
Okay, you know, I just got a question sent in from our own Ryan Gallagher, a great question. How important is the idea? This is going to be for you, Tyler, especially since you're sitting in a shop, and anyone else after that, Kate. How important is the idea that equipment in a space is professional grade?
It's a tough question. I mean, if you're looking at just the financing of it, it's pretty important to get good equipment that is going to last, first of all, and isn't going to break. What I'd say furthermore is investing in students in the way that they know how to actually fix the equipment when it breaks. Because what inevitably happens is a tool will break and students will walk away and never use it again, kind of thing like that. And so then it's on the administration or somebody else to invest in actually fixing the tool rather than getting buy-in from the students to actually to fix it, to maintain it, and to care about it. Those are kind of the key things that I'd look for. You don't have to buy Festool, like by any means, the top of the line, the best of the best, but I would be very strategic about where you're actually spending your money and buy a couple pieces of equipment. I would say, like, if you're looking at wood or even acrylic, stuff like that, buy a nice drill press. It doesn't have to be a standalone. It can be a tabletop one. Buy a good either miter saw or some tool for cutting. That can be a skill saw, anything like that. And then buy good measuring equipment. And then I would also say invest in materials. That doesn't have to be run out and buy a bunch of materials. It can literally go to the art store in their dumpster and start dumpster diving for good materials. That's one of the most important things I'd say that I've seen, is the tools are important, but materials are as important, if not more important, I'd say.
Okay, very good. Thank you. I've got another question from Pam Simon, and she talks about the funding of the school, and by which Pam assumes that we are meaning the actual physical space, and that is a correct assumption, Pam, and wants to know how we budget for the internal equipment, technologies, and maker spaces. That typically, we've had some luck with industry giving us some supplies, sometimes excess supplies, sometimes just the biotech industry helped us in particular in the early going with one space, and sometimes we just squeeze it out of our per pupil expenditure, but there's no great source of for equipment. I think that when it comes to certain types of equipment, like computers, for example, I think we've learned not to buy them all at once, because if you buy them all at once, they're all going to collapse all at once. So you sort of buy them in thirds, so to speak. So different ones collapse at different times, and they're kind of staggered. So that's it. I don't know what else really to say about that one. But well, every teacher has a budget. Go ahead, Patrick.
Well, I was going to jump into something Tyler actually was just talking about equipment. I think it connects to what you're talking about too, but there's two things. Like, I would say, like, especially if you're starting a school and you have a faculty that's going to be working universally with equipment on some level. At our schools, almost every teacher does projects, and all of the projects, like, need to live somewhere, at least that's the hopes. And I think one of the big things that you can push and also be sensitive to is that people who probably haven't worked with tools all that often when they're coming into the school for the first time. So really be pushing that they need to learn how to use the tools properly, and the teachers themselves, not just the students, but I think it really starts with the education of the teachers, learning how to use those tools, and then pushing that, but also being sensitive to how scary it is to use a tool for the first time. So if you're an administrator who's starting a school, you might have used a lot of tools, or you may have never used tools either, but you need to know how to use those tools if you're going to teach your staff how to use those tools. I didn't learn how to use any power tools until the last 6 years working at High Tech High, and it was one of the scariest things to go through at the beginning. But what Tyler was saying about materials is so important, because now I have a mural that's on the front of the High Tech High Chula Vista school that's built onto aluminum siding that has weatherproofing on it, because we're in the middle of the desert out there, and it has sunblock protecting. But I had to learn how to do all of that myself. But now we have a mural that's going to last for a very, very long time at the school, and it was so worth it compared to a project, and I've seen a lot of them, where the teachers don't know how to use the tools, and all of a sudden those projects get thrown out at the end of their use, and it's such a waste, even though it's a great learning experience.
Right, and we always have tried to have an ethos that you want a project to be something that the student is going to want to take home, or else it's going to be curated and remain on the walls of the school or in some type of space as an artifactorium, and not something that you throw out. Something that you throw out that tells you a lot about its relative insignificance. Tom from New Hampshire has another question here. He said that that we've been very focused on the High Tech High model. I apologize for that. There's a few of us here from High Tech High, so it's kind of a natural thing. And also for me, I taught carpentry for 15 years back east near you in New Hampshire, and a lot of my experience came from that. Issues of how to use tools and safety, working with people who had skills that I didn't. Mine were in wood. Fred Perry, as we mentioned, were in metal, and how I would be the person people would come to if they had a wood problem. I'd go to them if I had a metal problem, and it's not just something that happens here, hopefully. So I apologize for that, but you're asking another question here, Tom, which is, are there students for whom this idea is not really a great idea? Are there some other school models that we think could be interesting and might be complementary to high tech highs? As people consider the answer to that, because David has seen a lot of schools, and I know, Kate, you have in your work, and Tyler, in terms of high tech high, we just had some guests here today who are starting a new startup called E3, and I said, you know, the world doesn't need more high tech highs. What the world really needs are differentiated schools. We need more people trying new versions of different types of schools. That's really what we want. Can someone else speak to what else might be interesting that's out there? I mean, there's this, I'll just jump in with one more thing, which is Sprouts in Somerville, Mass., a really interesting makerspace school. I just was up at Maker House up in Seattle last week. Anyone else have something to, an example you've seen?
Well, I'll just jump in here. I mean, I've seen lots of examples of interesting schools. I work with a very broad range of public and charter and independent and lots of STEM and STEAM is a very big focus right now for schools. And I think that no matter what the flavor of school that you have, everybody is asking the question of, if we're going to be sinking money into designing a new school space, how can we make sure that it's not going to be obsolete 10 years from now or 20 years from now? Because we know that things are going to be changing dramatically. Things are changing dramatically. And one of the things that, of course, someone like Clayton Christensen is predicting is that much of content will be delivered online and interactively. So what does that mean for how we look at spaces? But I think whatever type of school that you're looking at designing, you want to build in as much flexibility as possible. You want to emphasize sort of more of a variety of spaces within the school instead of just the double-loaded corridor model, because really the model we've used has been around for over 100 years and it hasn't changed that much. A lot of people are just building nicer versions of those kind of like hallways, double-loaded corridors with lockers. But when you put lockers in the hallway, for instance, you really limit, first of all, you make it seem institutional, it's noisy, but you also limit views into the classroom, you limit what you can put on the walls. And so I think that a lot of people are kind of stepping back and looking at, even if we're doing more kind of, you know we might be doing a more traditional program, but how can we create environments that are more flexible? And one of the themes that I keep coming back to or see people coming back to is extending the learning beyond the walls of the classroom. Because when you think about 21st century skills, whether you have a more classical or traditional approach or not, it has to include and involve a more inquiry-based approach. And so that is going to imply that your teachers need to be collaborating more, they need to be modeling that for students, your furniture needs to allow your students to collaborate more, and there needs to be more of a variety of spaces within the school.
Okay, thank you. And since we just talked about online a little bit, Katerina from the Netherlands, who always asks great questions, has two of them. The first one's for Patrick, and the second one, I'm guessing, is for Kate and Tyler. And the first one is, Patrick, applying the concept of facility design to online schools, how should an online school or classroom like this one be designed?
That's an interesting question. But I think one of the things that I purposefully thought about when designing this online environment for students is participants was having a constructivist sense of like how people were communicating. Like it gave them specific ways to communicate as opposed to letting it be a free-for-all or pinpointing it on being a free-for-all. Like when you ask students questions, they're talking. And I think that that's a really big thing, because when people enter spaces, any kind of space, we all just want to know what we're supposed to do as individuals within that space. And I think when you're designing for that, that focus of each individual knowing exactly what they're supposed to do, then you have an overall like positive experience for the individual in that space. But you have to do that for everybody.
And partly, Katerina, there's something that's really as a longtime face-to-face teacher and now doing it online, like last week's class where I was in Seattle, you know, with my laptop all alone in a hotel room, it was really kind of strange. So, so this is something I think that we're all kind of getting more accustomed to. Okay, the next question is also from Katharina, another good one. So for those of you like Tyler and Kate, I think, but anyone else can jump in. If you only had one room in a school or one room that you could arrange a makerspace in, how would you arrange it?
So I would say, again, going back to what I mentioned before, that the most important thing would be making sure that you arrange it in a way that's supporting the pedagogy, the way that you're planning on teaching and interacting with the students. If it is going to be more project-based, that's going to look a lot different than if you're planning on having primarily a lecture format for your classes. I think the other important things to consider that are often overlooked in schools, I'm not sure if most of the people in this class are looking at high schools, or is it any middle and elementary?
It's a little bit of everything.
So particularly with middle schoolers and especially elementary school, one thing that's usually overlooked is how things appear from the kid's perspective. You know, if you get down to like a kid's height, what is that kid seeing and how are they interpreting the space? Most spaces are designed for adults and for someone that is at the height of an adult. So kids, and the other thing is that kids aren't just tiny versions of adults. They are developmentally very different. And that's another thing that's not generally accounted for. Just the way that they move and interact with space is a lot different. Again, I think it depends on what the type of learning is that you're planning for the space, and also taking into consideration who the students are and how they interact with the world.
I think one thing, too, to add on to that is the fact that oftentimes we childproof things, so to speak. We don't want any indication that a student has been in or out of a classroom most of the time. And so it's like designing that space, say it's a makerspace, that immediately when they walk in, that one, the pedagogy, as Kate was talking about, of the school is affirmed, and then two, that the students have a space, like that's their space, that they can either pin things up on the wall, that they can actually have whiteboards to activate, that they can have display cases to actually show things. Those are important kind of elements for a kid to actually walk in and feel comfortable making. If that's what it's about, if it's about making things, if it's about creativity, if it's about exploration, then the space should actually reaffirm that and allow for that at the same time.
Yeah, I can also say that, like, one of the scariest things in the beginning of design, like a school versus where, like, say, High Tech High is at now, because Chula Vista, I was there when Chula Vista opened and everything was blank. I actually remember seeing it as foundational, like a foundation building, and we came to visit here, and there's this beautiful artwork everywhere, and we haven't gotten there yet, and it was really daunting, but I can tell you that hard work in the beginning to get to push for those exemplars of student work to get up on those walls is so important, because when your ninth graders come in through the door for the first time and they see all this beautiful artwork up on the wall, and you say to them, your artwork's going to go up there too, they get scared. Like, they're like, no, it's not, you know, and that's a powerful, I mean, fear is not the driving educational force, but it is one of the ones that, it's because we believe in them, we know they can do that, and that's a very big transformational process that they can go through, and that has a lot to do with the space and how you're curating it.
Okay, next is from Stephen. Stephen Stolle is in Qualicum Beach, British Columbia, Canada. Is there a school size that makes sense for a school focused on project-based learning? What is too small or too big? While some of you are considering that, David and I first worked in a very, very big high school. And we endeavored on several different iterations to make it into smaller units. And I always suggest to people when you're thinking about what's a really good size, think about all of the private schools in your area. Why is it that people pay a lot of money to go there and there's usually 300 or 400 kids there? And in big cities, the public schools have 2,000 or 3,000 kids there. And if you're gonna, and public schools operate on far less money, if it's such a good idea to have really, really big schools and you're taking in so much more revenue in a private school, why don't private schools have 2,000 kids? I think they don't do it because it doesn't work that well. I think that, that proves that smaller schools are better because students are known and known well. David, do you want to say something about school size?
Well, yeah, I mean, I would say you definitely feel a difference in a school when it gets beyond a certain size. And yet, I think of High Tech High and sort of the original building that you're in, the Gary and Jacobs building, Larry, you said it now has 590 kids.
Yeah.
And we originally were envisioning about 400 kids in that building. And yet, the times that I've been there, it doesn't feel overcrowded. I feel like what's also important within a school, no matter what size it is to create smaller learning communities within that school. And so you create different orbits within the school. And those orbits have their own identity and their own group of teachers and students that tend to have more ownership of them and use them and take care of them and feel a sense of connection to them. So I think that's important.
Casimir, how many students attend Lick Wilberding, and was that too many, the right size, and how many people
would say
want to stop?
So I had to catch the last part.
And how many people were in a shop at one time?
I would say I would say it was about 400 or so, and I remember when I was a freshman, our class was considered a very big class, and their class was maybe 100 or so. Class sizes were small, which was very nice, actually. I was able to build a personal relationship with both my classmates and my teacher, and they were probably around maybe 15 at most, sometimes even smaller. And shops, so I would say probably about the same size, around 15. And the shops are very spacious as well, so we have plenty of space to move around, not worry about, you know, bumping into people. And people are making things from chairs to countertops to tables and things like that. So we have plenty of space within there, and I felt like it was a good size.
Okay, very good. Anyone else on that particular question? Okay, seeing none, I think we're about ready to wrap up for tonight, so we have an opportunity for last thoughts from everybody. So one by one, please sign off and feel free to toss any pearl of wisdom out there about space, tools, use of tools, type of population of students, what type of teacher you want inside those schools. Everyone's very shy.
Okay, I have a pearl of wisdom, and I'll sign off. Good night, everybody. It's been great to be part of this conversation. I think that what I see, what I'm doing more and more with the schools that I'm working with, and what I see working very successfully, and it connects to this whole notion of not just maker space but maker campus, is really looking at all the spaces in a school that you move through as potential places for learning. And it connects to that notion of anytime, anywhere learning. So learning can take place outside of the walls of the school and beyond the walls of the classroom. But if you look at it literally within a school, there are lots of great examples like Marysville Getchell School north of Seattle, where there are no corridors. Every space that you move through in that building is a space that can be used for teaching and for learning. And so it's a great way to maximize sort of the dollars that you're spending on the square footage of the building that you're creating. So I would say just really look at that closely.
Hey, David, I'm glad your cat got in the act before that show ended there. Okay. Tyler, And Kate, anything, any last thoughts from you guys? And then for Rose, and then Kashmir.
Yeah, thank you. First, it was fun chatting about this stuff. I think one is like the integration of makerspaces and the integration of making within schools has to be something that's integrated across the board. It needs to be adopted by the students as well as the teachers and as well as the administration. And that's a good space to do it. It's a good hub and a physical space to actually have like this galvanization around a community. The second thing is like when we're designing architects, designers, things like that, designing these, the more integration we can have of the students and the more integration we can have of the community at large, the better off the design will be and the more adopted it will be. And so advocating, if you're an administrator or somebody looking at developing these spaces, advocating for the designers to integrate you on a large scale.
Very good. I would say thank you so much for having us be part of the panel. I would say that keeping in mind that looking at the traditional school pedagogy, the culture or characteristics that it conveys are focused very much around surveillance, control, uniformity. So be deliberate about the decisions that you make about the space. I think that I haven't had the pleasure of seeing High Tech High. Hopefully I'll be able to go soon and check it out. But from what I know about it, the space is very much about exploration and creativity. It speaks a lot about the culture and the expectations of the students that are there. So just be deliberate and aware that every decision that you make is having an impact and communicating something about the culture of the space you're creating.
Very well put. Thank you, Kate. Feroz and Casimir?
Sure. I'm going to try and muster something. Flexibility. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So flexibility, no single-use spaces. Thinking about wall space, as David mentioned, no lockers for that reason. And also this idea that corridors are single-use spaces very often, but they don't have to be, and they shouldn't be. They are also spaces that can be used for teaching and learning and for displaying work. And I think kids will tell you a lot of what they learned in high school, they learned in the hallway. And I think that's something we can harness and use, actually. And that's all I have left in me. Thank you.
Great, thank you. And you used yourself up for us. Thank you so much.
And I would say for when thinking about school design, thinking about versatility, as people were saying, making sure it's versatile. Not only that, but as far as building in community buy-in, but think about spaces that invites the community in. Do you have community workshops and functions? Are you bringing in the parents? Are you bringing in the surrounding neighborhoods to see your school? And I think that also goes to outreach of your school, getting the word out about the makerspaces and why your school is different, and going to, if you're interested in attracting a certain student population, going out to those community events, going out to their neighborhoods, and inviting them in into the space so they can actually feel, they can get a sense of what that space is for them. Thank you so much to everybody, and thank you, Larry, for inviting me. I had a wonderful time.
It was great to have you, and everybody should who's watching this should know that both Feroz and Kat and Casimir, when they were in my Berkeley class, did great examples of designs of schools, which are available for you to see. There's a lot of material there for you to take a look at. Thank you both for joining. Great to see you again, David, Stephen, of course. I'll be seeing you here soon for the Deeper Learning Conference. And Kate, Tyler, thank you guys so much. We love what you do up there in San Francisco. And finally, to my partner in crime here, Patrick, with my arm, the cartoon. Thanks again. Thanks for bringing your arm with you tonight, all right?
Okay. Yeah, well, and I was just going to say to the rest of the students, Keep an eye out, because we do have, and everybody who's on the panel, you guys should come check it out next week. The students are actually going to be presenting their designs for their schools in the community that they've been working on for the past 6 weeks as a part of the new school creation move. Because next week's our last week. So look for that stuff. It's going to be amazing.
Thanks, everybody. Thank you, Patrick. Tyler, again. Okay, Casimir.
Thank you.
Rose. Thank you. Okay, good night, everybody. Bye-bye.